At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
No, it's not like everybody's opening up their fallout shelters, but come on. There has been a certain Cold War quality to the past week, wouldn't you say? This time, though, it's international trade, not tactical nukes, that's the real weapon. So today, a Marketplace special.
Now, we must be ready for a new danger.
How I learned to stop worrying and love the global economy. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's the 7th of March. Great to have you here on this Friday, everybody. A little something different on the broadcast today in light of everything that's been going on over in Crimea and Ukraine. And that vague feeling of, haven't we kind of been here before, but not in a good way at all?
And so until men of goodwill have turned this awesome power to peaceful uses, let us recognize the threat to our way of life.
I've got a picture that I dug out of my garage yesterday, back from when I was in the Navy. I flew off the aircraft carrier USS Theodore Roosevelt. We used to get sent up to the north coast of Norway. This was back in the mid-80s, the days of Ronald Reagan and the evil empire.
Because we remained strong, the Soviets came back to the table.
And we'd go up there, take off the boat in the middle of the night, and go looking for Soviet nuclear bombers. Tupolev 95s, to be precise. They'd come out of the Soviet Air Force bases in Murmansk, fly around the North Cape of Norway, down past Iceland and the UK on their way to their launch orbits, the spots where they'd make their nuclear bombing runs on the east coast of the United States. And our job was to keep an eye on them, make sure that they knew that we knew that they were there, which is very Cold War, right?
And when we are finished, the only sound they will hear is our laughter.
That picture I was talking about is from October 1988, one of the intercepts that I was on. A Soviet strategic bomber, big red star on its tail and everything, surrounded by four U.S. Navy jets, somewhere over a really cold and really gray North Atlantic Ocean. We are, obviously, a long way from that. It's different this time, but that's kind of the point. Everything is different this time, not just the Cold War world, but the world economy. And that gets us to our theme for this Friday, how I learned to stop worrying and love the global economy.
We must be ready for a new danger.
You can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Once more, we play our dangerous game.
Context in economics and geopolitics is, of course, everything. Who is doing what to whom and what happens as a result? So with that in mind, we will start on the ground in Ukraine. We've gone back to the BBC's Natalia Antalava. She is in Simferopol, the Crimean capital. Natalia, it's great to have you on again.
Good to be on the show.
First of all, what's the mood now, I guess, a week into this whole thing?
Nervous. I would say even more nervous than it was a week ago, because things are moving very fast here, while there are all sorts of negotiations and talks going on the international level. You know, basically this morning people woke up in Crimea not quite sure whether they're still in Ukraine or Russia.
Are they using the phrase Cold War? I imagine it means something different over there than it does over here.
It does. And actually, Cold War has never been the phrase very widely used in the former Soviet Union. So that's not the phrase people are using. But the sentiments are certainly the same. There is a lot of anti-Western feeling here, especially among people who are publicly supporting Russia.
What's happening in daily life? Can you go to the corner market and buy a loaf of bread? Are prices going up? Are shelves stocked as much as they ever were?
Prices are going up. I mean, people have been telling me that they have been stocking up on some things like flour and the basics. But the city on the outside is functioning normally. I was at the market this morning talking to local women selling vegetables, and they were complaining about the prices. But again, they were saying this is okay because soon once we join Russia, Putin will look after us. He will take care of us. I was talking earlier today to an analyst, but a very pro-government analyst here pro-Moscow analyst who was saying that this is great news economically for Crimea because he expects a lot of Russian investment. He says Russia will pour a lot of money into the place. And the government is even saying that they're already making plans to introduce the ruble here. But wow. I have to say, no one really has any explanation on how it will all work.
What about you? Does it feel like a Cold War to you with the tension on the streets and the physicality of it all?
You know what it feels like? It feels like the 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I myself am Georgian and I grew up in the post-Soviet Georgia. And I remember very well the separatist wars that took place there and the breakaway republics that we inherited from those wars in Abkhazia and in South Ossetia. Yeah. They aligned themselves with Russia. They are using the Russian currency. The Russians have given them passports, like they're giving passports out here in Crimea. But they never developed as either autonomous within the Russian Federation, because they're not, or as independent states. And there are these frozen conflicts that once in a while flare up, like Ossetia flared up in 2008. And that's what people here fear.
Natalia Antalava is with the BBC. We got her in Simferopol, the provincial capital of Crimea in Ukraine. Natalia, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Learning to stop worrying and love the global economy can be easier or harder depending on where you are, here or, say, Europe. And with Ukraine and Europe right now, a big part of the story is pipelines. There are dozens of them carrying natural gas from Russia to the EU. But this being a global economy and all, what happens in Ukraine is going to hit the West eventually. Russian troops in Crimea are going to affect gas prices, the price of a loaf of bread in London, how well companies like Pepsi and Exxon and a bunch of others do this year. So throughout the show today, a look by some of our reporters at some of those pipelines. We get going with Marketplace's Adrian Hill.
Kai, the modern world needs a few things. Gas, food, and markets that work. Let's start with energy. Russia's economy depends on oil and natural gas exports. It provides more than a third of what Europe uses, and most of that comes through pipelines in Ukraine. Daily flows of gas from Russia are worth almost $100 million a day. The largest consumer? It's Germany. Here in the U.S., we only get a little gas and oil from Russia, about 5%. But even small energy disruptions across the globe could mean we all pay more. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
We've got this regular thing we do on the program on Fridays, our weekly wrap, we call it, a look at the 5 days gone by. We will stay true to form today within the confines of our conceit, of course, not worrying and loving the global economy, Cold War or not a Cold War. For that, we've got Angela Stent with us. She is the director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. Ramesh Ratnazar is the deputy editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. Hello to you both. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great to be here.
Angela, just before I walked in here to the studio to talk to you, I was checking the news wires, and there was something on Reuters that said, Russian President Putin's spokesman says despite deep differences with the West over Ukraine, he hopes common ground will be found and there will be no new Cold War. Well, what do you think? I mean, we all hope so, right?
It sure feels like a Cold War at the moment if you listen to the rhetoric on both sides. But of course, this isn't a Cold War. This isn't a fight to the death between socialism and capitalism. We don't have our nuclear weapons targeted against Russia, although we could if we wanted to. And I guess the third thing is that because Russia is now part of the global economy, all of these territorial and strategic issues play out very differently than they did at the time when the Soviet Union was, you know, isolated from the world economy.
Well, Ramesh, about that point, so much has changed since the end of the actual Cold War. We are now so much more intertwined that there would be unbelievable global economic costs to anything really bad happening. That said, you can't ever assume the rational actor, right? Countries do stupid things.
That's right. And I think the important thing to do here is try to prevail upon the Russians to see that in the long run, they are going to be losers in this if we start taking some of the measures that we're talking about when it, you know, comes to economic sanctions, financial sanctions, the asset freezes, travel bans, all these sorts of things can, in the long run, I think, hurt Russia a lot more than they can hurt the West. So you're right that the interdependence makes it in some ways less likely that you're going to have a kind of Cold War style indefinite stalemate. On the other hand, it makes for more vulnerabilities on both sides. And that's why diplomacy and some effort to try to reach some compromise that allows everybody to save face, I think, is what's most important here.
Angela Stead, I was listening to the BBC on the way into work this morning, and I heard an analyst on one of their programs say the most astounding thing, and it literally stopped me in my tracks. He was talking about the interdependence that we all have, and he used the phrase mutually assured destruction, which takes you right back to the Cold War, except he was, except he was saying it in economic terms, you know, if the U.S. Go ahead. You know what I'm going to say?
No, I was just going to say, so funnily enough, we're now seeing the emergence of a new theory of deterrence, right?
Economic
deterrence,
right.
Mutually assured economic destruction. And I would say the other thing about sanctions is if you're talking about imposing tough sanctions on Russia, then there's always the small issue of Iran and the Iranian sanctions. And what's to stop the Russians turning around and saying, you know, I don't think that we're going to comply with any of these things anymore if you're doing this to us. So it works not only between Russia and the West, but in other crises where we are working with the Russians.
Where then are we, Ramesh, in 6 months? Are we still talking about this? Are there still Russian ground troops in Ukraine? I mean, sorry, in Crimea.
Yeah, I mean,
Or even more of Ukraine, I guess. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think that's a key point. I mean, I think if the United States and Europe and, you know, the rest of our allies have a coherent and unified strategy here, we can convince Putin that it is just not in his interest to move further into Ukraine and destabilize the situation even more. Are the tools that we have available sufficient to essentially kind of keep a lid on the crisis where it is at the moment?
Fair enough. Angela Stent from Georgetown, where she is the director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies. Her book is called The Limits of Partnership U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. Ramesh Ratnazar from Bloomberg Businessweek is deputy editor there. His book is called Tear Down This Wall, A City, A President, and the Speech That Ended the Cold War. Thank you both very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to pick up on that idea of the pipeline that we started earlier. The thought that what's really going on here is that we're all connected to what's happening in Ukraine because of how the global economy works now, 20 years after the end of the Cold War. Goods and services, fuel, commodities, pretty much everything in all of our economies flows from one part of it to another. So the next pipeline, food. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in London.
The Russian moves in Crimea have raised fears about food prices. Ukraine is known as the breadbasket of Europe. Along with the US and Australia, it's one of the world's top three wheat exporters. And it sends a lot of that produce out of the country via the Crimean Peninsula. The risk of this trade route being cut off pushed up grain prices this week, but not by much, thanks to an expected surge in American grain production. Before the crisis, the US government had been forecasting that because of this abundance, grain prices would fall to a 10-year low. But all bets will be off if there's all-out conflict in Crimea. That could send the cost of bread in Europe soaring. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Food, check. Energy, check. Next, China. And Marketplace's Rob Schmitz.
Stephen Beard just mentioned Ukraine's importance to the global breadbasket. Here, it's more than that. China's investing overseas to meet its food supply needs, and Ukraine has been an attractive option. Large swaths of farmable land has drawn the attention of Chinese companies looking for new places to cultivate grain and cattle. In fact, China signed a $10 billion trade deal with Ukraine. It's now Ukraine's second largest trading partner. China is already Ukraine's largest military customer, and China's investing in Ukraine's infrastructure. Structure, energy, agriculture, and finance. I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think Russia really needs attention. This is a country that desperately needs to be on the world stage at all times. Otherwise, it doesn't feel like a superpower.
Cold War, not Cold War, you decide. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 30 points today, 0.2%, finished at 16,452. The NASDAQ down 15 points, 0.3%, 4,336 there. The S&P 500 added a point. The fractional gain ended at 1,878. For the week that was, the Dow up 0.8%. The NASDAQ bumped up 0.7%. The S&P 500 climbed 1% on the nose. Lest you think we had forgotten, the Labor Department said this morning we added 175,000 jobs in February, about 30,000 more than many economists had expected. You did think we'd forgotten, didn't you? Sectors with the biggest adds, companies who support other companies, wholesale trade and food services as well. Construction and health care saw gains as well. Safeway rolled down 2.2%. Today, the supermarket chain will be sold for more than $9 billion to the private equity firm Cerberus Capital. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.79%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee holds a field hearing in Des Moines on preparing Iowa's children for success in school and beyond. 49 years ago, Neil Simon's The Odd Couple bowed on Broadway. Several versions have followed for film and TV and stage because you can't get enough of a bad roommate. Planning to be late for work? Tell your boss you forgot to roll your clock forward for daylight saving time. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is a Marketplace special, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Global Economy. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here is one key difference between the global economy of Cold War days and the global economy circa today. It's not just countries and politicians that have been rattled by the geopolitics of the past week. Companies have, too. Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
So the biggest issue for American companies is actually U.S. sanctions against Russia, because if they happen, Russia is drafting laws that could allow it to seize the assets and accounts of U.S. companies. And there's a lot at stake. Pepsi, for instance, was the first American company to do business in the Soviet Union. They've invested $3 billion in Russia. Boeing is at the beginning of a $30 billion investment in Russia. Part of that would be processing titanium to build its planes. But no doubt it's the oil companies that would suffer the most. Most have a stake in Russia. Exxon has sunk $10 billion into Russia and is heavily, heavily invested into exploring Russia's Arctic oil reserves. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
We've done a lot of historical comparisons today between what's been happening in Ukraine this week and what happened during the Cold War. So just to mix things up, another interpretation of the relationship between Russia and the world. Author Gary Steingart was born in what was, during the Cold War, Leningrad, now called St. Petersburg. He came to the United States when he was 7 years old.
Well, Crimea, we used to go there all the time, to Yalta and Gurzuf, which is a town nearby, and I would wear this kind of Soviet child Speedo, which was very sexy, I think. And we lived in this underground hut that was owned by Ukrainians, and there was a little boy there who was even smaller than me, and I was probably the smallest kid in the USSR, and I would beat him. I feel so sorry about it now. A Russian beating a Ukrainian, it sounds so prescient. But then the next year, a Latvian chicken bit me. And then a few years later, a Georgian kid beat me up. So I think there's a lesson in there for Russia somewhere. You know, you're hitting now, but you're going to get your comeuppance someday. The real country that we compete with economically and in terms of world power is China, and maybe down the line at some point India. I think Russia really needs attention. This is a country that desperately needs to be on the world stage at all times. Otherwise, it doesn't feel like a superpower. You know, I was in a cab in Moscow a couple of years ago, and my taxi driver was crying and saying, I don't have enough money to feed my family. I want to move to the United States. And I said, well, you know, you should try Canada because that's a great country and it's doing even better economically than the United States. And he said, phew, and he spit and he said, I can only live in a superpower. You know, one can be starving, but one needs to be a superpower. And Russia's been so shifted off of the world stage since the collapse of the Soviet Union that this is a nice way to get back in the game.
Gary Steingart, his latest book, A Little Failure, is a memoir about his American immigrant experience. That thing Gary Steingart was talking about, the idea of global superpowers, that's kind of what any talk of Cold War comes down to, isn't it? Where things hang in the balance of power. New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger thinks and writes and reports a whole lot about that. David, it's good to talk to you again.
Great to be back with you, Kai.
What was your gut reaction when this whole thing started happening?
My gut reaction was that while the United States may be feeling as if it does not want to get into what President Obama called a Cold War chessboard, that's still the way Vladimir Putin thinks about the world and operates in it. And so we have to make a decision about whether or not the U.S. wants to play by his rules or play by modern world rules.
All right, so indulge me as I go through the conceit of the broadcast today. It's not a shooting Cold War. It's an economic Cold War now because so much has changed since the end of the 1980s, right? If that's the case, though, what are our weapons?
Our main weapon is the president's favorite non-combatant unit, which is the Treasury Department.
Yeah.
And here you've got a Russian economy that is much more integrated with the West than it was at any point up leading up to the fall of the Berlin Wall. And you've got many, many Russians who are dependent on financial transfers. The difference this time, though, is that the Russians have as many ways to get back, at least at the Europeans, to whom they sell so much gas and oil, as we have to inflict pain on them.
If that's the case, then what does that do to the domestic calculus economically here? Does it change our budgeting process? Does it change things on the Hill with the White House? What happens?
Well, the president had the unfortunate timing, and this was pure coincidence, of sending up to Capitol Hill a defense budget just before this broke out that would eliminate a lot of old Cold War systems in favor of more money in the places that would seem to be the future. Drones, cyber, special forces, a revived and different kind of Navy to be able to do the Asian pivot. That's probably still the right strategy, but you can imagine at a moment that a old traditional kind of conflict over borders breaks out that everybody who wants to go defend the interests of old ways of spending is now going to have a new argument to do so.
This is kind of a loaded question, but do you think the administration is deluding itself into believing that the president's favorite non-combatant whim of the Treasury Department will actually be effective against President Putin and the Russians?
In this case, the biggest thing the president has going for him is that investors that the Russians desperately need in their oil sector, other energy sectors, they will be all reluctant to come in, particularly if Russia begins nationalizing some European investments in Crimea.
Oh, man, wait for that to happen, right? That's a whole different deal.
It is, but, you know, the Crimean parliament and the Russian parliament have all been discussing that as a possible reaction to sanctions.
If this continues for another, I don't know, 6 months in Ukraine, just to pick a number, do other things get squeezed out of our priorities here?
I think it's possible, but I think it's also possible that if the conflict remains to where it is right now, which is Crimea, it may well fall off the high priority list fairly quickly. Certainly that is Vladimir Putin's bet. I think the bigger cost, Kai, could be that over time, the hope that Russia would help the United States with other conflicts, Syria, Iran, North Korea, or that President Obama's vision of driving the U.S. and Russia together down to much lower levels of nuclear weapons, which would save us a fair bit of money, I think that those are all pretty well gone at this point.
David Sanger, national security correspondent at the New York Times. David, it's always good to talk to you.
Great to be back with you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, a final thought or two, really, about the broadcast today. It's not a Cold War. We know that. Nobody's aiming missiles at anybody. The doomsday clock isn't ticking closer to midnight. And that picture I dug out of my garage the other day, it is just and still a pretty cool memento, which is good. That's the way it ought to be. I hope it stays that way. But the bigger point that the global economy has changed so much since the Berlin Wall came down, that the phone in my pocket was invented here but built in China using parts from dozens of different countries, that's the whole ballgame now. And it's the economic foundation for all of the geopolitics that we've been watching for the past week. So the next time somebody tells you the economy is boring, send them our way, all right? You can hear our special coverage, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Global Economy, by signing up for our podcast. It is on iTunes or at marketplace.org. And while you're there, check out the digital slice of our coverage, what Ukraine's trading partners are saying. We've got Cold War film clips as well, and that picture I've been talking about all day. It is marketplace.org. And that's it. That's the show from APM on a Friday. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lindemann. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.